The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Werke, Judge Flory, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. The next case on the court's calendar this morning is Nealens versus Perry, and it's by Interactive TV Video, ITV. I want to make sure we have eyes and ears on everyone who will be arguing. Who is arguing for appellant in this case? Would you stand and state your name?
Eric Hansen, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Hansen, could you move for a second? So I'm sure that we're going to be able to get a video of you because we're not seeing you. Well, that's concerning.
Still no video?
Still no video. Okay, who's appearing for Ms. Perry? Now we've got him.
Your Honor, Scott Witte.
Yes. All right. Okay, so we can see Mr. Witte. We can hear Mr. Hansen, but we can't see him. What can we do about that?
All I've got is a number of videos.
Oh, there you are.
There you are.
Here.
You're here. So with that, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your argument. We don't want to lose you. Go ahead.
Fair enough. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Eric Hansen, and I am here on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Mr. Vilnius Nealens. This case is before you, the court, today on a motion for summary judgment in which the district court granted summary judgment against my client on the issue of claims for unjust enrichment. And those unjust enrichment claims are broken into really kind of two categories. Unjust enrichment for a piece of property, we referred to that in the brief as the homestead property, and the other was the business property. Ultimately, the district court's conclusion is a fairly thin one. The district court relied upon a one-off statement in Mr. Nealens' deposition in which he said that he did not have any evidence to support the claim as to the valuation of the property, and then proceeded to disregard what was frankly an extremely detailed affidavit in which Mr. Nealens went through and laid out over the course of nearly 20 years what he had done for this property, whether that was building a barn on the property, building a home on the property, putting a road in. He basically laid out in his affidavit and in the exhibits, and specifically I'd say exhibits A and B to his affidavit, lays out a really detailed course of labor that he put in on the property.
So Mr. Hansen, what evidence was there then? I don't think anybody disputes that he did work on the property, but over the 19 or 20 years that they own this property, what evidence was in the record that those the work he did on the property actually contributed to the increase in value?
But that certainly can be based on market curves, that can be based on other factors besides, I'm not saying that the laborers didn't contribute, but don't you have to sort out what, with specificity, he did?
Well, to be clear, it did specify in his affidavit what he did.
Well, right, but what I'm getting at is you're arguing that the way I'm hearing you is you're saying that the biggest piece of evidence that you have as far as the value of the work is that the market analysis was at $60,000 and then boom, it's at $360,000. And what I'm trying to say is that there's other variables that certainly go into the appreciation of land and buildings over a period of time. I mean, you must agree with that.
No, I do agree with that. And if there is a valid criticism here, I suppose that it is that the affidavit submitted by Mr. Nealens is that he didn't specifically tie all of the different construction aspects that he did, like putting in the road. He didn't say that was worth $20,000 to the overall improvement of the property. However, I would say that the case law on this is pretty clear. If we look to, for example, Schumacher versus Schumacher, that level of specificity on an unjust enrichment claim simply has not been required. So to the extent that the court is troubled by this, I would say that ultimately that's a question for the fact finder. And that's why you don't cut off these claims on a motion for summary judgment. The question from my construction of this is, was there evidence in the record to support evaluation? And I would say absolutely there is. And then the purely legal question is, you know, does it have to somehow tie up in a more specific, you know, whether or not the court's requiring expert testimony or something to link specific construction projects to specific dollar amounts?
But wasn't there expert testimony? I guess my question is the district court found that evidence speculative? And for instance, was there evidence in the record that said these folks or Ms. Perry bought this land in 1996 as bare land? It was worth $360,000. That same bare land at the time of the appraisal would be worth X figure, but with the improvements, it's worth $360,000. Was there that type of evidence in the record?
To my knowledge, there was not. It was simply the initial purchase price, which was $60,000, and then the 2016 appraisal. But I would say that, you know, it was not like Mr. Nyland simply said, oh, I did a bunch of work, and judge, go figure out what that's worth. He quantified that. He quantified it in detail, he provided receipts. Really, the question is whether or not that linkage is something that the court's going to require for purposes of a summary judgment. And I would respectfully submit that if this court goes respondent's direction on that, it's going to represent a change in how Minnesota courts have dealt with unjust enrichment claims.
How so? How would the change? What would the change be?
So your argument is essentially if the facts are viewed or the record is viewed in the light most favorable to your client, as we must, by simply showing the increased value of the land, that's enough to get you past summary judgment. And then at trial, you have to prove up which portion of that increased value is attributable to the efforts of your client.
Say it was not just the 60 to the 360 increase in value. He did provide specific numbers of as to the time, labor, supplies that he invested. And I think that is relevant evidence to the question of what is he entitled to from an equitable standpoint.
But as I understand your argument, it's you presented enough evidence to raise an issue of fact regarding the amount of any unjust enrichment. as opposed to a case where no evidence was presented regarding any increased value, there'd be no basis to assume that you could prove it up. Here you're just saying you haven't proved it up yet because that happens at trial.
Correct.
Okay.
And the only cases that I have seen in which a summary judgment on an equitable claim, unjust enrichment claim like this, are ones where the court says there's nothing to establish damages. And that is certainly not the case here. And that's why I view this as respondent's argument being a departure from the current status of law, is that it's unquestioned, undisputed, that there's more than nothing in this record. And they're arguing for a higher bar. And I would simply submit that the case law doesn't support that, that assertion. Unless the court has other questions, I would say ultimately that's the crux of this case. But I do want to at least touch on this issue of the anti-palimony statute. Specifically make it clear to the court that, I think that this falls squarely within those cases that have kind of carved out an exception to the anti-palimony statute. And I would say that in this factual circumstances, we actually have an even more compelling case than, say, In re Estate of Palmer.
The district court didn't rely on the anti-palimony statute, did it in any way?
It did not. It rejected it, and I think that analysis was correct. I just thought that it was worth discussing, because even if the court were to agree with me that there was sufficient evidence to survive summary judgment on the equitable claim, we'd then have to grapple with the anti-palimony. I think that issue is before the court. If the court's convinced I win on that point, I'm prepared to leave it alone. I do see that as being an issue that the court, should appropriately address, as the district court did weigh in on the point. I guess the main point that I was trying to make there is that what we have on the record here is somewhat unique in that, the anti-palimony statute's designed, the language is in contemplation of sexual relations. We have record evidence that sexual relations in this case ended in 2005, and so we have a decade worth of work on this property and on this business that there's nothing in the evidence to suggest that was subject to the anti-palimony statute. So I think that just makes the district court's findings on that more correct. But I think that the court has to address that issue once it gets past the question of, is there evidence of damages present for unjust enrichment? Unless the court has other questions, I will just wrap up here and say that, I think we cited this in our brief. The Schumacher case, in which the parents are talking about, the court goes through in that case and analyzes what the individual invested in terms of time, money, and effort in improving a property. That's exactly this case. So I would respectfully submit that respondent's argument to the contrary, you'd have to overrule Schumacher in order to get to the result that they're urging, that this level of evidence is insufficient to survive summary judgment. I think that is simply new and something that would be, shocking to our district court judges that the level of specificity has gone up, and that those specific connections have to be made. I don't think that that's what our case law says. I don't think it's supported by the equity in this case. And ultimately, these are equitable claims. And so I would respectfully urge the court to reverse the grant of summary judgment, send this matter back to the district court for a trial on the merits as to the
Mr. Witte, are you ready for argument? Where's Mr. Witte? Mr. Witte?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm here.
All right. Give us a second, because you're not showing on our screen yet. Could you maybe move? That sometimes will trigger the camera.
All right.
Perfect.
My clerk is telling me to talk as well. So
that is working. Would you introduce yourself for the record formally and then begin your argument?
I will, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the Honorable Panel, Counsel, my name is Scott Witte, and I am appearing today on behalf of the defendant in this matter, Respondent Elizabeth Perry. Since the underlying facts have been, I think, adequately detailed in both parties' briefs, and as well as the court's order granting summary judgment in favor of my client, I'll move directly into what I see as the two principal issues before the court. The first, which is, can the appellant seek a remedy against a properly organized corporate entity that is not a named party in this lawsuit? Second issue I would like to address this morning is, can the appellant pursue an unjust enrichment claim without any evidence tending to show added value to respondent's property, which was directly attributable to him or his contributions?
So on that issue, Mr. Witte, I know this is in reverse of the way you had presented the issues, but it seems like that is the issue that was focused on during appellant's argument. Why, in your view, is the testimony that an increase in value, evidence that an increase in value of $60,000 to $360,000 over this 19-year period, why isn't that enough to survive summary judgment?
Your Honor, the courts have held quite clearly that all elements of a claim must be supported by evidence that is not based on conjecture and speculation to get past the summary judgment barrier. And one of the elements in this claim, as I believe pointed out in the Zirinsky case, is that the claimant, the plaintiff here, or appellant, must show damages or amount of recoverable damages sufficient in a way that allows a justifiable finding by the fact finder in the court here. And to do that, the appellant must show that not only has the property that he seeks constructive trust against increase in value, but that some amount of that value was attributable to him.
Well, do we really think a reasonable person could look? I mean, if the record shows the amount of the increased value and the record contains evidence showing the improvements he made to the property, could a reasonable person look at that record and say none of that increased value is attributable to his efforts?
Your Honor, I believe that a reasonable juror could say that the plaintiff has failed to prove with any evidence that...
Not my question. Because we're here on summary judgment, and I'm going to tell you, I'm a little concerned. Our review is de novo, so I don't need to be concerned with the district court's reasoning, but I am concerned with the district court's reasoning because you appear to be asking us to adopt it as a basis to affirm. At summary judgment, I'm not sure that plaintiff has to establish with certainty the amount of damages in a way that's not based on speculation or conjecture. I think plaintiff just needs to put forth enough evidence to show that reasonable minds could disagree as to whether or not the value increased, and if so, how much. Now, what I see from the district court here is he didn't present evidence showing the exact amount of any improvement or value resulting from his improvement, but he presented evidence that established a metric by which the court could measure damages. So the district court has said the record's adequate for someone to make a damage calculation. He just hasn't done it for us. And then the district court goes on to say he didn't meet his burden of proving damages. He didn't establish the amount of increased value owing to his improvements. I mean, I get the sense that the district court applied the standard that we would apply at the end of trial to see whether he met his burden of proving damages, which is not the standard we apply at summary judgment. At summary judgment, we're just saying, is there enough evidence presented to raise a genuine issue of material fact as to damages, and there's a genuine issue of material fact when people could disagree regarding whether there were damages, and if so, how much. And so as I look at this, unless a reasonable person would look at this record and say, there's no way you could reasonably conclude that his labor and materials contributed to the increased value, that's what you'd need for summary judgment. And it seems like he's presented enough evidence to show that it's reasonable to conclude that the increased value is a result of his efforts. It's just a matter of determining what that amount is. Right.
The loss of the plaintiff. And the fact finder would have to have some evidentiary basis to say that the damages to be awarded are $10,000 versus $25,000. The evidentiary basis for something like that could be an appraiser's determination of the plaintiff's work had a direct contribution to the increased value of the property in X amount, or perhaps even the party's opinion testimony. But that is not, I think the court has to be careful and remain confined to the evidence in the record. And there is no such evidence in the record. The appellant has described the work he thinks he's done here, but he has not articulated, and that is the burden of the party, the plaintiff in this action, to get past summary judgment. He has not articulated what facts, whether it be testimony, a documented report or expert testimony, expert opinion, what it is that a jury or judge could determine or base a determination of damages on with any degree of specificity. It is, maybe an analogy I could use here is, we've heard the saying that you throw as much mud on the wall to see what sticks. Well, in this case, I would suggest that what plaintiff has done is thrown sand at the wall. There is nothing that can stick here that a fact finder can use as actual justification based on the evidence in the record that says, I'm going to select or determine the amount of damages in this case, which is the unjust
gain. But counsel, I agree with everything you're saying. My question is, do we have to have that degree of specificity in the evidence at the summary judgment stage? Or does he simply have to present enough evidence to raise a genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not his contributions benefited the defendant? And the record contains descriptions of the work he's performed, his estimated value of the work, and his contributions, as well as evidence of a significant increase in property value. If that evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, doesn't it suggest that there would be a basis for the jury after a trial with a full presentation of all the evidence and the issues to conclude that his efforts contributed to the value of the property in a way that benefited the defendant? I agree he hasn't proved it here now, but I don't know that he has to prove it here now. But do you agree, counsel, that you could have a situation where certain evidence is presented at summary judgment that doesn't limit the evidence that could be presented at trial? More evidence could be presented at trial on the damages issue. The question is, did he present enough evidence on the damage issue to raise a genuine issue of material fact, which requires an assessment of whether reasonable minds could disagree regarding whether he increased the value of the property?
Your Honor, I don't disagree that additional evidence could theoretically be come up.
Okay. Do you think, could reasonable people look at this and say, yeah, if we viewed the evidence in the light most favorable, it's possible that he's going to be able to prove up damages? Because that's the standard.
Making a connection between two points with no
Okay.
And I think that the Shoemaker case, Your Honor, did you start to raise another question?
No.
Okay.
You weren't interrupting. I'm sorry.
The Shoemaker case relied upon here heavily by the appellant here. I must point out that at the end of the paragraph that is block cited in the appellant's brief, it does say that we express no opinion on the elements or amounts of appellant's claim for damages because these have not been addressed by the parties or the district court. That sentence in alone, I believe, is telling us, offering guidance to us, that there could very well be a motion in that Shoemaker case prior to trial wherein the respondent or the defendant would say the plaintiff has failed to show adequate evidence of damages to survive summary judgment. That is the case, what we have here, Your Honor. And if I can perhaps make a couple more comments on that. I did want to address one other thing that you said. Part of the evidence that has been offered into the record is this, what counsel described as a very detailed description of the work that the plaintiff did here. And that is evidence of something, but I do not believe it is evidence going toward damages. And the reason I say that is, going back to the measure of damages for unjust enrichment, Your Honor, it is the measure of gain, the gain to that has been unjustly retained by the defendant. The amount of work or what the plaintiff did has little or no relevance to the amount of gain retained by the defendant. That is a separate measure, and it requires someone to say there's been X amount of gain, and if some degree of this gain or all of it is attributable to my efforts. I couldn't go to my neighbor's house, Your Honor, help him build a shed, okay, and 20 years later assert that the shed has improved the value of his property, and I can show, let me take a step back. I can't say that, Your Honor, my neighbor's property has increased in value by $25,000. It was my work 20 years ago that improved it. I would need to have myself offer an opinion, or an expert say by how much that is. Otherwise, we have defendants getting hauled into trial unnecessarily based on no evidence of showing this connection.
Well, your client, Ms. Perry, acknowledged in her deposition that he'd contributed labor, work, and improved the property. I mean, is that... What I'm getting at is, summary judgment is when there's no facts in dispute. So you have your own client even indicating that he improved the property. Isn't that enough to survive summary judgment? That we would then say there's a question of fact as to what the value was?
Your Honor, I disagree, and the reason is that I believe that it is plaintiff's burden to show what degree of, first, that there's increased value attributable to him, and second, what that value is. And in addition, Your Honor, there could be a lot of things done, a lot of work completed, a lot of things purchased for even the property that have no impact on the...
Well, he had a lot of things enumerated in his complaint, and that's a part of what's looked at also in summary judgment, you know, the complete record. He had many things that were enumerated.
Some of those efforts were, creating a road, making pasture, cutting wood.
Well, I agree. So I agree. And in your brief, you've itemized those issues that include with maintaining the county road and use of a backhoe and a dump truck. And I agree that that doesn't necessarily correlate to property increasing in value. But as far as I can tell, those are the only two things that don't cross over, at least lend a reasonable mind to consider the fact that this may amount to an increase in property. I'm not the jury, but summary judgment, it just seems as if some of these decisions have been made without a trier of fact making a decision as to what the value would be, if any at all.
And Your Honor, it is plaintiff's burden to show
counsel. Mr. Hansen, do you have rebuttal argument?
I do, Your Honor. Do you see me yet?
Yes, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start out with a quote from Schumacher specifically, and it's right above where opposing counsel quoted. It says, appellant has provided evidence that he made substantial improvements on the respondent's land, that respondents knew of those improvements and either encouraged them or did nothing to discourage them, and that respondents have benefited from them. This evidence is sufficient to create genuine issues of material fact for the jury. I do not believe that you can square that language with their argument. There was sufficient evidence to create a genuine issue of material fact. And the other thing that I would ask the court to look at specifically is in document 30, which is the affidavit submitted by Mr. Nylands. Paragraph 7 of that affidavit talks about the market analysis and goes through and says, I understand that the labor and materials that I have provided, typo, exceed the increase in value, but they increase the value nonetheless. That's the evidence. And I would respectfully submit that ultimately the question of how much those investments of time, labor, and actual cost increased is a question for a fact finder and not an issue for summary judgment. And I would also, I think this point is bolstered by, decisions in two other cases, specifically Anderson versus Delisle, in which the court talks about valuation and it says the rule cannot be applied mechanically to situations where the alleged value of improvements exceed their cost. And it says equity cuts both ways. I read that decision to say that equity requires that these issues go to a fact finder. Similarly, Minnesota Supreme Court in Faust v. Parrott, which is a 1978 decision, says the law certainly does not require that damages be calculable with absolute precision. Issue is whether or not it's ascertainable with reasonable exactness. And I would submit that Mr. Nyland's affidavit and the other evidence in the record provides exactly that. For purposes of summary judgment, you do not have to connect those dots in order to survive summary judgment. You do not have to say, this road was worth $10,000 of this gain. He has alleged that there is a gain to the homestead and the business, and that was attributable to his labor, his time, and his investment in those properties. That's sufficient for purposes of summary judgment. Ultimately, Your Honors, this is a matter that was cut off prematurely. The district court needs to hear the evidence. These dots should be connected. I would respectfully submit that if Mr. Nylands at trial fails to provide the necessary connections, then, a finding similar to what we have here out of the district court may be appropriate. However, we're here on a motion for summary judgment. Your Honors, review it de novo. The question is whether or not he met that basic standard of providing any evidence upon which a fact finder could make a determination of value. And I would respectfully submit that he has. There is not guesswork in the sense that you wouldn't have a fact finder say, well, it must be $1 million. We have a range. We have a range that's delineated by the difference in purchase price and valuation, and we have a range that's delineated by the amount of time, effort, materials, and money he spent on this. Those are the necessary data points that a reasonable fact finder can look at and say, this is the number that we believe is properly appropriate for attributable to Mr. Nylands' work. That's what an unjust enrichment case should have, and it was cut off here by a premature decision of the district court. So we respectfully ask that the court remand this and direct the trial court to set the matter on trial.
Thank Thank you. Thank you to both of the attorneys. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. Thank you. Do we need to leave for them to set up, or can we stay here?
We stay here.
Stay here? Okay.